Thanks for downloading Radio 4's The Digital Human. I'm Alex Krotowski. In this program, Diaspora. Can you paint me a picture of what the market is like in Mali?
Okay, well, the markets are really crowded places. There's lots of noise, there's lots of energy, there's lots of business. So a lot of shouting and lots of transactions taking place. If you get into the cell phone parts of the market, where people are selling old, used cell phones, there's a lot of music being played too. The point of the music being people advertising it to sell.
Is it like Battle of the Bands? It's just louder and louder and louder.
Yeah, it's this arms race. I mean, everyone's trying to turn up their music to be louder than their neighbor until they're all maxed out.
My mother lives on the east coast of the U.S., my father in the south. My grandmother and uncle are on the west coast. The rest of my family is spread all over the world, some in Poland, some in Australia, some occasionally in India, France, Central America. And I live here in the UK. We're a family of people hooked on migrating, on getting lost in other cultures. And in this edition of The Digital Human, I'll be exploring how people across the globe use technologies to keep their cultures true in an increasingly globalized world. We're asking whether technology is a threat to cultural differences, and what happens to our sense of who we are when we go somewhere else in the modern age. I'll be on Twitter throughout the program, tweeting links to more information. And you can see them at any time on our website. Follow the conversation live with the hashtag DigiHuman. First up, if we can identify a movie from Hollywood, cuisine from France, and animation from Japan, why do we think software doesn't wear a similar cultural badge? Daniel Miller is an anthropologist and author of several books, including Tales from Facebook.
I work a good deal in Trinidad, and Trinidad, if they use one word to define what they see as their cultural values, it's often the word bacchanal. And bacchanal refers to kind of the scandal and the confusion that tends to arise from gossip. So when Facebook came along, Trinidadians really took to Facebook like sort of ducks to water, because it all seemed to be about kind of being nosy and scandal. And then I think there was a time when sort of getting inappropriately tagged in the wrong photo was almost like a national pastime in Trinidad. And you can see the link there between what they saw as core values and simply what they then saw in this new technology as something that almost appeared to them as intrinsically Trinidadian.
But with this global adoption of digital technologies, is there a risk that we all start to become a bit too similar?
Technologies can look like they are cultural homogenizing. An example that I'm very familiar with would be something like PowerPoint. Pretty much wherever I go in the world these days, people are expecting me to use PowerPoint, and they have pretty similar ideas of what that implies. But there is a problem here, because yes, I think PowerPoint looks like cultural homogenization, but PowerPoint tends to be used in sectors such as higher education or in business. And both higher education and business were already areas in which we see a great deal of cultural homogenization.
We heard Chris Kirkley's voice earlier. He's an ethnomusicologist from Portland, Oregon. He spent a year in Mali in West Africa looking to capture traditional Tuareg music. He was searching for an example of a cultural expression that was uniquely Malian. But what he found was something else.
I was headed out to find something sort of folky, and what really caught my ear when I was there was some of the new experimentation that kids were making with computers, with, you know, hacked copies of PC-based software, drum machines, auto-tune, and sort of experimenting with these tools with this traditional guitar music. So combining these in new ways.
Yeah. One of the bands that Chris has kept in touch with is Kaba Blon from Bamako, the capital of Mali.
Malian music is for us very, very important because it comes from our country. We have our own customs and traditions. We prefer making songs with our traditional instruments. But for instance, even if you take the name of our band, Kaba Blon, its very name is something ancestral.
So what happens when you combine new technologies and global influences to the very traditional Malian music sound? And with everyone using the same technology across the globe, does that begin to subtly undermine the unique aspects of musical expression in different cultures? Now that Facebook has reached almost every corner of the earth, are we in danger of a Facebookization of the world? Are we auto-tuning global culture? Pedro Irsabal is a researcher at the University of Bilbao, where he specializes in what impact the digital world has on diaspora communities, communities of people who've left one country to live in another. He uses Basque culture as the basis for his research.
Technology is not neutral. There is a cultural context where that ideology, which is fabricating this technology, occurs.
So if there's a cultural slant to a piece of software, how big a problem is it that so much of the technology that the world uses was developed in the United States? Are the cultural values that are inherent in the technology having an effect on everyone else's attitudes?
Now, we have this phenomena that Silicon Valley is developing all these new technologies, okay? And you could be right when saying, okay, how we can adapt the use of this technology by locals or ethnic identities. My answer to that will be that local minorities, ethnic minorities, are utilizing and adopting these new tools regardless of the ideology behind it. The way, for example, of being very individualized. I did this, I wrote this, I wake up this morning, and so on. When I do the research on how, for example, Basque diaspora associations work, how they are using this American technology, they are not using it in a way of I, they are using it in a way of we.
So what Pedro is saying is that U.S. technology is developed from an individualist perspective, I, me, and mine. But in the Basque region and in many other areas around the world, their default perspective is more collectivist. Us. We. Ours. By using a technology that rewards individualism, is it changing how they view the world? The danger with that perspective is that it suggests that we're blindly accepting what it is that we're being given without pushing back. Danny Miller doesn't agree.
I think we have to be careful because if we start seeing one society and saying that, oh, it's adapted or transformed that particular technology, then we would be led into the trap of thinking that that technology has a kind of given, as you say, culture of its own that's kind of innate to it. And I don't think that's really true. So although, say, Facebook developed in the US, when you look at the way it is used, it's probably not what Mark Zuckerberg had in mind. In other words, technologies are really the way a particular region happens to use that technology. It doesn't exist outside of that pattern of usage.
Danny Miller believes that technology is a social construction. In other words, the meaning that's attached to it and what we use it for are determined by a kind of social consensus, depending on where it's used.
I think we tend to assume that these technologies come from the West and it's a question of whether people in other regions do or do not adapt them. And often that's a mistake. The first really well-developed and established social networking site was actually something called Cyworld, and it was developed in Korea. Now, why didn't that spread this way? I think it does have something to do with language dominance. Korean is not a global language. English was already establishing itself as a global language, so maybe it's not that surprising that Facebook, which tended to derive from an English-speaking tradition, has managed to spread itself around the world in a way that Cyworld, as Korean, failed to do. the technology is also, in a sense, changing what people understand as their culture. A given way of using a mobile phone becomes almost the experience of, oh, that's the way we Somalis do it, or whatever it is. So people now see their own culture, often in terms of the familiar uses of new technologies, because they encounter somebody else from a different society, and they're slightly shocked to find that that person is using it differently.
For Chris Kirkley, exploring the musical culture of Mali, it wasn't just how technology was transforming how music was being made that fascinated him. It was also how it was being consumed.
Well, one of the interesting things about the West African sonic landscape is that it's always awash in this blaring, tinny music that's coming from cell phones.
Was that something that was pleasurable, or did you end up getting migraines on day three?
Man. Yeah. I thought it was terrible at first, you know, and it took me a while before I saw this music and this phenomenon as actually something worth looking into.
What did you find? How did you look?
You know, the cell phones are housing music collections. So there's a lot of MP3s that are on people's cell phones that you can't find anywhere. They're not on the internet because these people aren't on the internet. You can't buy them at the market because a lot of the songs were produced locally on PCs. So the music contained within these phones is a sort of a closed repertoire of music that you can only find within cell phones.
What Chris had uncovered was an undiscovered treasure chest of cultural expressions that was largely invisible to the outside world, despite its technological manifestation. And he had to go to Mali to discover this.
Maybe they used to sit around playing guitar around the fire. Now you sit around playing a cell phone.
It's not just sharing for listening's sake. It's also literally sharing. So somebody would go up to somebody else and say, no, I really like that track. Can I have it?
Yeah, these cell phones have Bluetooth-enabled file transfers. So it's possible to send a song from one cell phone to the other. That's really the key thing for how this music is being shared and how this network of music is being created.
Can you imagine doing that on the bus home tonight? You can go to our website to see some photos. And wait a minute, we don't use Bluetooth anymore. We've moved on, haven't we? Didn't it die in like 2007?
Bluetooth transfer has been developing a lot these days. Through new technologies, you can record and then that you transfer the music. This is what enables us to organize small gigs. But the problem with Bluetooth is nobody pays for the CD or the tapes anymore. For our band, it's been okay because of the gigs, but amongst other bands, it is not going well. It is not going well.
How do the economics of this music industry work?
There really are none. There's no benefit to the artist, I should say, aside from promotion. The MP3s are often sold by cell phone vendors, but that money, it's not iTunes. That money's not going back to the artist.
Chris, there's a culture as well, isn't there, of musicians just going direct to market.
Yeah, it's been a trend for musicians to go directly to the cell phone MP3 sellers. So there was a band, for example, in Kidal, Mali, who last year had composed a new album, recorded at home, and they wanted to get more concerts and get more promotion for themselves. So they went around town paying, you know, a small fee, but about $10, I think, to every MP3 vendor. And when anyone came in to buy MP3s, they would say, well, hey, you should check out this new band. They're really hot. Here, I'll give you their music as well.
One thing that people have observed with the rise of the web in the West is more of this artists going direct to their audience. Is it a similar idea, or is it something that feels qualitatively different?
Since we've sort of cut through all the bureaucracy, we've also cut through the profit for a lot of these musicians. So if they're not selling CDs or cassettes, they can't make any money. So the musicians and the artists have determined a way that they're going to profit from it. It might not be financially directly, but they're going to make something back. And whether it's promotion, publicity, or even getting a message out, which is originally what a lot of this Tuareg music was about getting a message to people. So I think it's a nice poetic conclusion of the original intent.
We are making young people in Mali aware of their culture, as well as conveying some messages in order to try and give hope to the young people in Mali. This is what our job is about.
Is there still the emphasis in conveying a message in the contemporary versions of the Tuareg music?
Definitely, especially now with the rebellion happening in the north of Mali. Pretty much all this music is concerned with the problems facing Tuareg society. And I think that most of my musician friends would agree that right now, that message is the most important thing.
Up to this point, we've been examining culture and the digital world through a lens focused on the experiences of people who live in their native countries. And technology doesn't appear to be homogenizing that. Sure, we may all be using Facebook, but look a bit closer, and in situ, the way that Facebook is used is still very specific to where you're using it. But now we're going to take a step back and focus our lens on the migrant experience. How has the digital world changed it? Now, this is something I can relate to. Well, kind of. I came to the UK in 1994. After so long living in this country, sure, I miss my family and my friends, but we talk online. There are a few things that I really miss, except maybe baseball or the Super Bowl or graham crackers. But I'm lucky. I can always go back. My parents and grandparents, though, when they left Poland during the Second World War, weren't so lucky. And they didn't have the web to connect them back to what was going on with their family and their friends who were there. They had to cope with their diaspora without the amazing technology that we have today.
With the technology like with the Skype and Facebook, if I feel homesick, I can just Skype to my family and friends back in Kiribati and then just ask them to show me the sea and the sunrise and the sunsets or the islands through the video calling and then I feel at home and happy again.
A Kiribati Islander reflects on how she uses technology to keep home alive. Her home, however, will soon completely disappear. A very different experience to that of St. Lucian George Charlery.
My name is George Charlery, and I arrived in Liverpool in 1956. It took 14 days by sea to get to England. When I first came to Liverpool, it was a paradise, because you could leave a job today, and tomorrow you're in another one.
When George arrived from the Caribbean island of St. Lucia, like so many others, he didn't intend to stay. But finding himself here, so far away from home, he felt he needed to be with his people. So along with others, they formed the Liverpool St. Lucian Association and helped found the city's Caribbean Center.
What was relevant to me is for everybody to socialize together. And then we all will have a place that we all can meet and spend the time and have a laugh, have a kid, play dominoes, play games. And that was the atmosphere of it. And whenever they had a dance, it was all Caribbean music, steel band. Everybody enjoyed themselves.
Pedro Irisabal.
If you are talking pre-digital, you're talking a much different experience regarding emotional connections and disconnection. I do believe that psychologically, a person who are 10,000 miles away from home is going to think of a different way than a person that in a click, in a second, can make a phone call or can make a Skype call and see their mom and their dad on their brothers and their sisters. Imagine how different it will be for that person from this young man who lives in the 1900s. It would have been probably weeks until he receives a letter. Migrants, when they come to a new country, the first thing that they do is to get a cell phone and get a prepaid card and call family, or trying to get into a cafe, an internet cafe, and trying to email their friends.
We're moving from Wavertree into Toxteth, which is where most of the Caribbean families will have arrived when they came here in the late 50s and early 60s. This used to be a hive of activities.
George's son Peter inherited his father's role as chairman of the St. Lucian Association. But things are very different from the days when his father and his friends danced until dawn to the beat of the steel drums. The Caribbean Center now spends more and more of its time closed.
We're now at the Merseyside Caribbean Community Center, and on the sign we have six flags of the Caribbean. I'm mostly connected with St. Lucia via my father and his friends, because, you know, the Liverpool St. Lucian Association, as it was in those times, used to meet on a monthly basis. So that's really, you know, most of my impressions of St. Lucia were given by Dad and his friends.
But that image Peter has in his head is like a museum piece. It's a still photo that was taken in 1956. Contemporary St. Lucia is a different beast. It's moved forward 60 years.
What I have seen through my studies, particularly on the Basque diaspora, is that there is an obvious gap between homeland and diaspora. The homeland has moved its own sense of culture and identity, while the diaspora, they have their own sense also of identity. Now, when you see this being projected into cyberspace, you can see that there is a struggle between the migrant generation and the descendants about what Basque identity is. New generations are using more often and more wisely new technologies, and they are diluting that gap between their own sense of identity and the homeland identity. That gap is being narrowing. Regarding an older generation or migrant generation, they are struggling to recognize that homeland.
Digital technology can now keep people who've left in touch with the changing nature of their home country in a way that's different from previous generations' experience. The place that they moved away from continues to be a living, breathing, evolving place. Not one captured in aspic. And that can make institutions like the Merseyside Caribbean Center look outmoded, frozen in a nostalgic image of a homeland that's moved on.
You know, if I look at the people from my father's era, they were more like a family. Whereas now, I have experienced meeting young people from St. Lucia who I didn't expect were here living in Liverpool. We'd have always expected that one of the first points of call would have been to find out where other St. Lucians are. So it surprised me that, you know, folks who've set up businesses in Liverpool, folks who've come to the University Hospital to work, you know, they've arrived but never come to look as to where the St. Lucian community is. So obviously they're using other methods to keep together.
Peter Charlery. So what I see as the problem with culture in the digital age stems from a fear that we're losing what makes us different from one another. But at the same time, we think digital technology is great for keeping us connected to what and to where we've left behind. I think ultimately, what we're really mourning is the loss of what we feel is an authentic representation of our cultures. Pedro Irsabal.
Internet, without our particular memories, without our particular identities, will be nothing besides a connection of computers. Maintaining cultural identity is not that it is important. I think that is essential.
Oh, I think the anxiety has been there for a very long time, partly because we have this kind of illusion that societies exist in some kind of authentic, given relatively static kind of position. And actually, I suspect anthropology is one of the people who are guilty of spreading that kind of myth. And it's only as our studies have become more sophisticated that we've realized that actually they have always been dynamic and they've always taken from diverse sources. But I think particularly maybe today, because of the rapidity of change around us, that there is a growing fear and anxiety that we are losing something that was kind of given to us historically. And what's replacing it is seen as too kind of transient or too superficial compared to the way that we used to be. And that's understandable given that sense of the dynamics of change. But you can certainly see why people are anxious about it.
We think we know the world because we see everyone. We see them through our screens, and we see them using the same technology that we do. And we think that they're using it just like us. But in fact, when we actually go somewhere, like Chris Kirkley did, with expectations of finding exactly what it was that he thought he was looking for, we're often surprised and delighted to discover that we're still holding on to our cultural differences. Can you actually see something about the wider values of West Africa through this music network, through the sharing, through the economics, through the openness and the cacophony as you're walking down the street?
There's definitely a different value on space, on sharing. I guess I should say the concept of community and is a lot closer. Wow. It's kind of a difficult thing to put into words, but I feel that when I lived in Kidal, for example, we lived in a house with musicians, and there was about 10 people sleeping outside in the yard, including myself, every night. And it was people who were from other towns, cousins who didn't have a place to stay and decided they were going to stay at the house for a month, 2 months, 6 months, a year. And That idea of sharing space really translates into these activities of sharing music. There's a sense that it's a lot less individualist as it is here in the West. We keep our music collections private. We keep our lives private. And there really isn't the ability for financial or otherwise to maintain that level of privacy. So you definitely can feel that in the culture, but as well as how people interact with one another and share their sounds.
You've been listening to The Digital Human. Next week, we're asking how the digital world has changed how opinions are voiced and shaped. You've been listening to The Digital Human with me, Alex Krotowski. It was produced in Edinburgh by Peter McManus and researched by Elizabeth Ann Duffy.